Let's see, today is Wednesday, April 14th, 2010, and I hope to talk about the combination of mindfulness and renunciation tonight. And as a way into that, I wondered if anyone had a question or comment about the suggestions that I gave at the beginning of the meditation tonight. You may recall I suggested that you access or open to or encourage feelings of gladness, love, and peace. And on the basis of that, be given over to your choice tonight to sit and meditate. And on the basis of being given over to it, again and again, be here now, not wishing for anything else, and not caught up in selfing, but rather given over to abiding as breathing and meditation. So yeah, and all the way in the back first.
One of my questions is always going to be for me every week. Since I'm not great at the breathing thing, I always start my meditation kind of with a platform or of a theme. And my theme is usually abundance or the phrase, be still and know that I am God, that
yeah.
I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
Or just the word love. And I just kind of coat myself, my surroundings, my meditations, my thoughts, everything in that feeling or that, not in the situations of abundance, just the feeling of abundance. And I never knew that was okay because, you know, we never discussed that, and that was going to be one of my questions. But just you saying that thought, oh, of course. I mean, that clouds that meditation. And so every week I kind of have a different theme. And so for me, it was so perfectly said that was, you know, a way to enter meditation.
Great. You probably don't need to ask that question in future weeks because you've really got your good answer right there. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and to underscore that point, there are two parts here. One is, what are the attitudes or factors that we invoke or encourage or open to that promote contemplative practice? And then second, what is the object of attention? Okay, and just to underscore the points in what you shared there, first, it really is okay to encourage factors that promote mm-hmm. contemplative presence. It really is okay to do that. For example, one factor that's often pointed to traditionally is tranquility, some quality of peacefulness. And as I've sort of unpacked and elaborated in the last several times we've met, if we have these three fundamental systems of desire or motivation or response to life in us, in the causes and conditions of being human, namely a system that approaches, another one that avoids, and another one that joins or affiliates or attaches, right? And if it's the case that it's pretty hard to be meditative when one is caught up in chasing after pleasures, or, you know, fighting or fleeing from pains, or caught up in heartache or feelings of loss or separation or shame, right? On the basis of that, it's simply skillful practice to open to and gently, without falling into the pitfalls, key points of striving and ego control, to open to, in three words, gladness, love, and peace, right? And as well, there are other themes too, just like you said, abundance, which for me would go to the gladness theme. You know, there's no need for anxious grasping if there's already abundance, right? So however you do it, it's really okay to do that. And one way to do it isn't even to use words or themes. After a while, you just kind of start knowing that there's a body memory of the zone, of a kind of basic spacious well-being, right, that contains the objects of awareness. Okay? Kind of a basic contentment, which is sort of the essence, if you think of it, of gladness, love, and peace. Then there's the object of attention, and that varies. I use the breath because it's a common object, but I think for many people, the breath's not that useful somehow. It's either associated perhaps with painful, even traumatic memories, and then that's a problem, or there's just something about bringing awareness to it. It just doesn't kind of work. And then other people use, for example, phrases like loving kindness phrases, or phrases like be still and you know that I'm here, or just be still. Whatever it is, it's okay. It's okay. It's what works for you. In a sense, I think the ideal object of attention, particularly in kind of more the intermediate stages of practice, is one that is just stimulating enough, but it's not so stimulating that it lets us off the hook of developing our own concentration. Okay, one more person, and then I want to go on. Yeah.
I just wanted to say it was helpful to hear about making the choice and form the intention to renounce being anywhere else and any other time.
Yeah.
It seemed to really focus
in
a good way.
Yeah, I'm going to talk more about that, and thank you. Thank you. Okay. So, for what it's worth, I just feel overflowingly happy to be here. I just do. I appreciate you being here so I can be here with you. You know, but I mean it more like not just as an occasion. I mean, I really am glad to be with you. So I wanted to, tonight, share some of the common metaphors or similes or analogies that are used for mindfulness, because the larger focus this year, as you know, is a consideration of the third fundamental pillar of Buddhist practice, or one of the three, which is concentration or mindfulness. And so, as you probably know, we're using as our kind of basis the four foundations of mindfulness, which the Buddha laid out as, he said, a direct and sufficient path for enlightenment. Just that, the four foundations of mindfulness. And I heartily recommend this book. This book is listed on the page in my website about this San Rafael meditation gathering. And it's a wonderful book called Satipatthana, which is the Pali word for the four foundations of mindfulness. Sati is mindfulness. Okay? So from this book, I'd like to read about a page and a half, and I'll kind of slow down from time to time in it. There are four wonderful metaphors that are used, basically, and then I'll add a fifth, and then we'll talk about that a bit. Then I hope to do a brief paired activity, and then get into this notion of mindfulness as a form of renunciation. What? Oh, the page number? Great. Page 53. The imagery of mindfulness in this book. And you could check it out yourself. Okay? So, one simile or metaphor describes a cowherd who had to watch closely over his or her cows to prevent them straying into fields where the crop was ripe. But once the crop was harvested, the cowherd was able to relax, sit under a tree, and watch over them from a distance. To express this comparatively relaxed and distant manner of observation, the word sati is used. The disposition suggested by this metaphor is a calm and detached type of observation. The distinction there is between kind of anxiously hovering over the cattle, like anxiously hovering over the breath, or anxiously hovering over your attentiveness to the breath. Am I doing this right? Am I being attentive enough? Or you think about someone who's, you know, like a anxious child watching a caregiver, you know, like a hawk to see if it's all okay or not. Yes, there is a certain attentiveness there, but that's not really the quality of mindfulness, which has embedded in it a sort of spaciousness, like it's all right. You know, we don't have to. We're not white knuckling our way through this meditation. All right? It's like, and if there's a sense of all rightness too, that's again one of those factors I'm talking about, that prior sense of enough contentment. Right? An all rightness here. Okay? Then another simile supporting this quality of detached observation compares the practice of Satipatthana, mindfulness, which is established in four major places. Mindfulness is to be established in the body, broadly defined, in terms of all the sensations, including the senses, sight, sound, touch, taste, and smell, as well as not so much the interior sensations of thought. We'll get to that in a moment. And as well as the movements of the body, the actions, reaching for a cup while closing a book at the same time, and so forth. The second place to establish mindfulness is in the feeling tone of experience moment to moment, the hedonic tone in Western psychology of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Right? We are to be mindful of the feeling tone of our experience, and partly because it's that feeling tone that tends to drive the craving that leads to suffering. Right? The third place to kind of rest our mindfulness is in our overall state of mind. In particular, are we overall in a state of mind that leads to happiness and helpfulness, or a state of mind that leads to suffering and harm? It's kind of a global state of mind variable. And then the last one is we are to rest mindfulness in a variety of themes. And these are particularly Buddhist themes, like the five aggregates of experience in terms of form, feeling, perception, mental contents, and consciousness, or rest them in the Four Noble Truths. In other words, we are to be mindful of certain critical themes, which we'll get to later on in this year. Okay, so those are where we rest mindfulness. So one of the metaphors here compares the practice of mindfulness to climbing an elevated platform or tower. Connotations of aloofness, and not in a negative sense, but a kind of seclusion. You know, that's the metaphor that's often used. Find a place of seclusion. A kind of detached, uninvolved observation are confirmed by this passage, which contrasts the image of the tower, of a kind of detached, far-seeing, because it's raised above, right? Kind of a global view, not caught up in the madding crowds. That's contrasted to being carried away by the stream of desire, right? In other words, when we are mindful of, to use an example, of the fact that it's spring and there's a certain feeling in the air and certain smells even in the air, there's a mindfulness of that. And that's contrasted to being caught up in really wanting it always to be spring and hating winter, right? There's a distinction there. Okay, okay, great. So that's the second metaphor, watchful in a tower. Detachment comes up again in another sutta, which compares Satipatthana to the taming of a wild elephant. Just as a recently captured elephant has to be gradually weaned of its forest habits, so too Satipatthana can gradually wean a person from memories and desires related to suffering. Okay? Any comments so far? We have so far the metaphor of, you know, relaxed observation, like a cowherd of a happily grazing herd of cattle. And then we also have a metaphor of a kind of a tower, right? And then we also have the notion of taming. Okay. I'll keep going then. Another metaphor compares sati to the probe of a surgeon. Like the surgeon's probe, whose function is to provide information about the wound for treatment, so too the probe of mindfulness can be used to carefully gather information, thereby preparing the ground for subsequent action. In other words, we observe what leads to what. Certain factors, certain attitudes, certain thoughts lead to happiness and opening and non-attachment and glimpses of a sublime peace. Other mental activities get our knickers in a twist, get us caught up in comparing and judging and wishing and, you know, wanting it always to be spring, or wanting our book to always be super duper popular, or whatever it is, you know, wanting our favorite political party to always be in the White House, whatever it is, we see what leads to happiness and what leads to harm. Okay? So it gathers information. This ground preparing quality is conveyed by another metaphor, which is one I really like, which is relating mindfulness to the goad, which is the jabber, and the plowshare, which is the plow of a farmer. Just as a farmer has first to plow the ground in order to be able to sow, so too mindfulness fulfills an important preparatory role for the arising of wisdom. And there's a footnote which explains it further. With the help of the goad, there is a little bit of prodding, right? If the mind is, in a sense, if attention is a little bit like the ox that's hauling the plow, we got to kind of keep the ox going up and down in the straight and narrow. All right, we don't want to wander too far afield, starting to think about what one's going to do with that gift card for Gap, right, or something like that. All right, okay. And so, but on the other hand, with that goad, with that directness, we have a continuity of plowing. In other words, we keep the ox on track while the plowshare penetrates the surface of the earth, turns up its hidden parts, and thereby prepares it for seeds to be grown and planted. Similarly, continuity of mindfulness keeps the mind on track with regard to the meditation object, so that mindfulness can penetrate the surface appearance of phenomena, turn up their hidden aspects, such as the three characteristics of impermanence, interdependence, and suffering that arises from craving and clinging, and enable the seeds of wisdom to grow. The fact that plowshares and goad are mentioned together in this metaphor points to the need to combine clarity of direction with balanced effort, right, in developing mindfulness. In other words, the farmer has to do two things at once, has to keep the ox going up and down the right direction and exert the right amount of pressure for the plow that's turning over the earth. The same too with us, in a funny kind of way, isn't it? We got to keep ourselves being mindful, and while sustaining a kind of openness to ever-growing clarity about what we're mindful of. And now just, I think, a couple others. The role of mindfulness in supporting of the arising of wisdom occurs again in another metaphor, which associates the parts of an elephant's body with mental qualities and factors. They were big on elephants back then. A lot of elephant metaphors in Buddha Dharma. Here, mindfulness is compared to the elephant's neck, the natural support for its head, which in the same metaphor represents, of course, wisdom. Interestingly, the choice of the elephant's neck is significant since it is characteristic of both elephants and Buddhas to look around by turning with the whole body instead of only the head. I love that little metaphor. You know, yeah, there's a place for turning just your head. I mean, we have a neck, let's use it. But I love the idea that what we turn toward with our whole being. You know, much as the elephant turns toward something with its whole being, well, a Buddha and the Buddha within each of us, awakening day by day, turns toward what it is mindful of with a wholehearted presence. Isn't that great? Think about how often we give people half-hearted attention. You know, we're multitasking while we're on the phone, kind of trying not to make too much obvious noise. Are kind of talking to our kids, sort of, while we're watching the game. And we count that as quality time with dad or mom, what have you. Think about that. How often we don't turn toward a person with our whole attention and just give over to this moment with them. And can't you, of course, feel it when another person just turns to you with their whole being and is given over to you for this moment? That's a common description of the Dalai Lama, just to use him as an example. People routinely say, yeah, when you're with him, you know he's got a lot on his mind, but you feel like he's just there with you. That's all that really is going on right then. That might be over in 20 seconds because there are 400 people in line who want their 20 seconds. But for that 20 seconds, you got him entirely. You know? How often do we let others have us entirely? Yeah, Dixie. Yeah, you're exactly right. One last one, and then we'll do a little practice. of, I'm looking for the clever word, I can't find it. We're going to do a practice of channeling our inner elephant. Okay? So, just to summarize here, let's see. Yeah, and then the last one is that the supportive role of mindfulness in the development of wisdom comes up again in a metaphor in which mindfulness keeps the streams in this world in check so that the faculty of wisdom can cut them off. In other words, that mindfulness guards the sense doors. Mindfulness, remember, is recollectedness, so that we don't forget ourselves or lose ourselves and get caught up in greed or hatred or heartache, broadly defined. And then act out without recollectedness in ways that are promoting of suffering and harm. All right. So these four metaphors, the surgeon's probe, the plowshare, the elephant's neck, and keeping the streams in check, as well as the other metaphors, of course, of the tower, you know, the spaciousness of the cowherd who can relax about the cows, all establish a preparatory role for insight. In other words, sati, mindfulness, is the mental quality that enables wisdom to arise. Okay, great. Any questions or comments so far? You might want to kind of pick it minimally your favorite metaphor. You don't have to remember them all. It's kind of, you know, you might think, okay, what would help balance me? Is it the cowherd that I need to relax a little bit? Is it the tower, so I want to have more of a spacious panoramic seeing? Is it the goad that keeps the ox on track, you know, on the job, up and down, breath by breath by breath by breath? Is it the surgeon's probe to not just kind of zone out in this nice relaxed fuzziness, but to have a certain discernment, discrimination? But what is it for you? Is it perhaps as well the elephant's neck? You know, really giving yourself over to, you know, what you're aware of. Or even does there need to be a little firmness so that you kind of don't let yourself get caught up in chasing after desires of various kinds in the mind? Don't think for yourself. And so now what I propose to do, and you can always opt out of anything I ever suggest, or and feel free to do it your own way, is that in a minute, not yet, you get a partner, and that you pick an A and a B, A's will go first, and then for 3 minutes each, one of you will talk and the other will basically listen. It's okay to ask a question or wrinkle your, shake your head if you don't quite get something. It's okay, you're not just doing non-response sharing. That's another workshop. That's right. That's another workshop. But anyway, but if you're listening, here's the scoop. Choose to listen and continually give yourself over to just being there, because that's where you are, right? Since you're here, consciously renounce being anywhere else, doing anything else but listening and being present with your partner, and do that repeatedly and know what that's like. Does that make sense? In other words, since you're listening, you might as well give up to listening. And so just listen, giving up everything else. Surrendering.
That's the topic.
Yeah, that's good. But you get but I'm emphasizing what's really important, which is the listening. I could have you, the topic I actually thought of deliberately having you do something really boring as a speaker, but no, why don't you just talk about yourself and mindfulness? Okay? So if you're speaking, you're talking about yourself and mindfulness, that'll be valuable. And if you're listening, you're really focusing on mindfulness to what the other person's saying as a practice of renouncing everything else. Okay? And then I'll give you a time signal. I'll say switch, and then we'll switch, and we'll come back and talk about it. This is your inner... If you're a listener, you're in the mode of inner elephant. You're turning toward your partner with your whole body, your whole being. Okay, grab a partner. If you're willing to do this, pick a pair.
No.
And if you want a partner and don't have one, raise your hand. One in the back. Anybody else? Here's a, right, you two? You two? You two? So, do you see her? There you go. And it's okay to hang out with a dyad and just watch them. Okay, everybody have a partner? Pick an A and a B. A's are going to go first. Okay, so A's, in a minute, you're going to talk about mindfulness. B's, you're going to consciously choose to be a listener and then renounce everything else and do that repeatedly and know what that's like. Got it? Begin. That's it, elephants. That's right. So, what was that like, especially the renunciation part? What did you notice?
The renunciation part?
The listening part, where you just gave up. You just gave up all other purposes. Yes, in the back.
I find myself losing focus a lot. Feeling tired, kind of, and having to redouble my effort to make sure that I was paying attention, and so I focused on different things that she was saying to draw myself back in.
That's really interesting, and I think there are always a lot of details, and I'm very aware of that kind of effortful attention, but on the other hand, I think it's an interesting experiment. What happens if we renounce, we abandon distracting mind streams, even at the first moment of their arising, and we even abandon fatigue and we abandon everything except being given over to the fullness of this moment? And I don't know, I think that's the experiment to run. And it reminds me actually of the line from Michelangelo sculpting David, which is that he said, Michelangelo said, essentially that he just chipped away everything that was not David. You know, he renounced everything that was not David, and then there was David. Well, I appreciate you sharing that. I just think that it's interesting to explore what that's like to be really given over. And I often find that when one is really given over, it's actually quite energizing. It's our resistance to what this is. You know, being given over to that is not very stimulating sometimes. It's just... And yet, weirdly, life gets unbelievably rich when we give over to moments that are not very stimulating. Yeah, right? Because then there's a very, very strong sense of being alive. Yeah. Independent of the content streaming through that moment of aliveness. There's this aliveness itself that stands forth because the content is so minimal. So, yeah. Marion.
Doesn't your ability to listen fully depend really upon whether or not you have a relationship, prior relationship? Chuck and I know each other pretty well. It's not very difficult to listen in such an environment, but if we were paired up with people we had never had any contact with, then I think that might be an experiment that's quite different.
Sure, could be. Did anyone have a partner that they didn't know well? What was your sense of being able to be present with that partner? Yeah.
I found the opposite, that it was, for me, very relaxing and enriching, because my mind is so busy, overly busy all the time, that I'm always thinking about the grocery list when somebody's talking to me or whatever, and I hate that.
Yeah.
So I found it really, really fulfilling, and it felt like I had... I mean, love's not the word, but, you know, caring, and I found it very relaxing.
Yeah, that's great. Ditto, okay, and even though you didn't know each other. So I think there are nuances. Some of the deepest conversations I've ever had were when I was hitchhiking, and I just ended up talking with the driver, or, you know, you meet someone on a train, or something like that. So, but it's nice. What it's like to just, for that time, just drop it. Drop the grocery list, drop the plans, you know. Yeah.
Michelle and I don't really know each other well, but about 2 years ago, we did this similar in your training brain class, and it came back really quickly. And the conversation kind of picked up from where it was 2 years ago.
Oh, that's interesting. That goes to Marion's point. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, a couple more. Yeah, go on.
I just noticed moments of empathy where I can relate to the other person's feeling.
Was that aided by renouncing self-involvement in a way and just being given over to them and whatever the moment was?
Yeah, because it was a surprise. I didn't expect it.
You didn't expect the empathy?
Yeah.
Or
the relatedness.
Great. Yeah, Linda?
I think because of the direction of the exercise, I actually noticed the joy of the renunciation. I just noticed, oh, there's nothing else I'd rather be doing.
Yeah.
And it was effortless to get there. So I'm grateful for the direction to appreciate the joy of that.
That's wonderful to call that out, that you're doing here. That renunciation, which often has this grim, dour, abstaining, asceticism, blah, blah. You know, you're really talking about a kind of joyfulness and just like, there's no resistance to the moment at all. And what is that? That's a moment of awakening, of contentment and peace. And,
I'm not sure how to say this, but I became aware while we were talking, Ocean and I were talking, of in one moment of my 12-year-old son and how I try to be very mindful about really paying attention, not having one eye on something else or on another conversation or something. But also there's a resistance that I became aware of just when it just flitted through my mind, which is he may be talking about a video game or something that's totally captivating to him. And part of me is doing this at the same time that I want to know what it's like for him. And there's a come here, go away kind of quality.
I totally get it. No, like when these kids, especially boys, they go on this run about, the hit points and the power-ups and I got to level up and the boss, and, dad's here, like they're in this internal self world. But, then that's what we're given over to. There we are. We're stuck at Thanksgiving, right? And our great aunt, Uncle Charlie or Aunt Sue is telling the same story for the third time in a row. And there we are. And then the question is, do we resist the moment we're in? If you're not going to walk out of the room, it's the moment you're in, right? Right? So you might as well renounce all else except being in the moment that you're in, whatever that is. And then what happens? And I think it's to be truly mindful is a renunciate act.
I'd be a listener as a renunciate act. We missed that. We forgot about that part. But I think we're pretty good at listening. Yeah. But, really, if you're listening, you're not doing any of that other stuff. So you are renunciating the rest of it.
By
nature.
I have found personally that it's helped me to remind myself that this is what I've chosen right here. I've chosen this moment. I've chosen this setting. I've chosen this role. Whatever it is, I've chosen to have children, I've got a 12-year-old, I've chosen to have video games in my kid's life, whatever it is, here we are, okay. And just to be given over to it, and to remind oneself periodically, because I think that, I don't know about you, but I tend to have a kind of muscular, problem-solving, fix-it, pushing against life to make life better kind of stance. Anybody else? Any other Americans in the room? But anyway, and that tends to regenerate, or the mind, if you probably have noticed this about the mind kind of is endlessly scanning for something to want. Mm-hmm. Something to want or something to fix. And it just kind of scans. All right, just sort of spotlight on Rome, and then, there's going to be a Macy's sale this weekend. Or, these guys have got to fix my pond. I'm going to plan that out. And then we're caught, right? And what's great about mindfulness is that we basically, you know, renounce that. In other words, we have to keep regenerating the renunciation of that tendency to get carried away, to get to become lost in thought, and then by definition no longer mindful. You see what I mean? So you might want to play with that in settings, especially settings where you start feeling kind of restless or sort of wishing you were somewhere else or your head's not really in the game. You know, you're turning your head, but you're not turning your whole body, as it were, to the moment, to the situation. And then just keep going, look, do I want to leave? In which case, leave. Or if I'm here. Be given over to what it is. What do you think? I think when we're given over to what it is, then that really is one of those factors that promotes mindfulness, as well as what Linda was saying, a kind of peace of mind and joy. Renunciation, by the way, is a critical aspect of Buddhism. You know, make no mistake about it. It's a key element of wise intention or right intention is the intention of renunciation. Right.
So I'm not sure where I would go when I'm sitting at Thanksgiving and I'm hearing it for the third time. I mean, am I just putting myself in my body and practicing on my breath, or am I? I've been there. I can probably go back in my memory to think where I went, but or you know, am I empathizing with that person? I'm not sure where
I would be. I think, in my opinion, I think there are times where, how can I put it, they've got our body, but they don't have to have our mind. Right? There's a place for that, I think. But I think the distinction is between the ordinary mode of being lost in thought, hijacked by these streams of desire or aversion, right? Or a choice, let's say, to think to myself, this is my Uncle Charlie. If I get up in the middle of his story, it'll be weird. It'll be a bad vibe. I think what I'm going to do is reframe this moment into, you know, what my choice is here and now, consciously. And so my choice here and now might be to really listen to my kid's story. Or my choice here and now might be to have 10% of my awareness nodding in rhythm to Charlie's story, while 90% of me is just kind of running through a mental checklist of what I've got to pack up to get the kids in the car and out of here in a couple hours. You know, and then that's the choice, but then we give over to that. But I think, and then we're mindful of what we've given over to, and we fully give over to it in a wholehearted way. But I think oftentimes, in a peculiar way, if we don't make the moment so much about us, you know, and just kind of give Charlie our best presence. For what? It's usually not that long, right? It's usually like 3 minutes or 20 minutes. Right? Feels I know like 3 years. But it's just usually 20 minutes. And it's kind of curious and interesting. It's a wonderful experience, experiment. What happens if we just give over to the moment as it is? Like give over to being stuck in traffic. Here I am, stuck in traffic. You know, here I am, forced to watch Lost or something, you know, or, you know, whatever it is, you know, which for me is this very strange show. I don't get it. But anyway, that's the experiment, you know. And I think, I don't know, for me at least, it's been really fruitful to experiment with renouncing everything but being here and now in this. And maybe one more and then we'll move on.
I like the idea of hearing it anew, acting as though I'd never heard it before, and I'm going to catch things in the story that I didn't recollect. Yeah. And they never told me in this date and time before.
Yeah.
They told me before, so I hear it anew. And when I'm in a car, I say I'm in automobile flow rather than traffic.
Yeah.
Then it facilitates the flow and it's feminine and I keep it going. And I think traffic is the word to red flag and forget about.
Yeah, that's great.
Who wants to be congested?
That's great. So this week, so I want to move it to a wrap. This week, it's up to you, but I really encourage you to play with this idea of, you know, being here now, being mindfully present, and renouncing all else. being mindfully present with whatever you're present with, whether it's doing the dishes or just walking across a room, or planning when you need to plan, or problem solving when you need to problem solve. Being mindfully present in whatever you've chosen to be present with, and abandon all else. Give up. Yeah. Okay. So before we do one last little minute of sitting, I would like to do a bit of housekeeping. First of all, I really want to acknowledge you, Julia, for being just spectacular in terms of helping manage so much of the logistics here for pretty much since we arrived at Falkirk. And I think you've been a critical person. And Julia is stepping down from that role to give herself more life balance, or to quote Gil Fronstall, who's a teacher and teacher for me lately. He said, sometimes it's undharmic to take on another Dharma activity. So I think there's a place that the greater Dharma is served by dropping some Dharmas. But anyway, dropping some Dharmas while still continuing to come, of course. And I mean you've been really very, very helpful. For the logistics here, I think what would work is to establish two or three people who are kind of co-chairs of the benefactors committee, the angels, the logistics angels, and then also set up almost like a schedule of a couple other people who will just be there on a given date with the person who's sort of the coordinator. Do you see what I mean? And then we'll know who's going to be here when. I'll know. That'll relieve my mind. It'll help me be better at what I try to do here, to not worry about things being handled. And so I just want to ask you, now we've had about half a dozen people or so volunteer to be part of the logistics team. In other words, to be willing in part to come for sure at least once a month to help set up and take down. Anybody else willing to toss your hat in the ring as someone who's willing to come occasionally and commit to coming, you know, about 15 minutes early to help set up? Anybody else? Great. Good. So why don't you, if you're in the anybody else category, and feel free for other hands to go up, why don't you just join me up here in a moment, and then I'll get your name and email address, and then I'll set up a way of communicating and kind of organizing this. Okay? Easy. And it's a great way to participate in Sangha, in community, to help out. You know, it's funny, I was reflecting on the way here how buoyed I am by the opportunity to share and to give. You know, I think all of us really want to be helpful. And I often reflect on at the heart of the suffering of a lot of people, including, for example, a lot of teenagers in this culture, is thwarted contribution. You know, we want to help. We want to share love. We want to be giving. We want to be kind. We want to help this moment become a little better for the person we're talking with. Coming here a little early and setting up chairs, or as Tarne and others are doing, you know, handling the refreshments. It's a wonderful way to have the joy of giving, the joy of generosity. Okay, let's sit for 1 minute or so. And you can notice what it's like to give yourself over to simply this moment of sitting. Thank you for your mindfulness. Mm-hmm.